in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. Registration is not required and individuals can join at any time. For more information, call 384-5829 or www.livingyogacenter.net.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll look back to the influenza pandemic of 1918-1919. And our guest for the program is John M. Barry, who's authored a book entitled The Great Influenza, The Epic Story of the Deadliest Plague in History. Viking is the publisher. The book's been out now for a little while and is available in the bookstore if you'd like to take a look at it. It's a story of this outbreak of influenza, about some of the ideas of how it started, how it was spread, and some of the people in the medical and scientific community that tried to battle it. It's a fascinating story, and if you're interested in learning in depth, you can seek out the book. Of course, here this morning on the program, we'll try to give you the basic story and give you the opportunity to ask questions. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, we'll pay for the call. In and around Illinois and Indiana, that is out of the direct area here. If it would be a long-distance call, you can use the toll-free line. Also, if you would happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Barry, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
No one knows, apparently, precisely how many people died as a result of this influenza outbreak. People do have some rough ideas. Roughly speaking, how many people do we think were killed?
Well, as you say, it's very rough, really. Usually the newspapers refer to more than 20 million. That number was a contemporary estimate. But the reality is, since then, the number's been revised many times, and every revision has been upward. And a Nobel Prize winner believed a minimum of 50 million people were killed, possibly 100 million. And that's in a world with a population only 28% as big as today. So if you adjust for population, that's roughly somewhere between 150 and 300 million people being killed. Most of them died in a period of a few months. So, I mean, this was an explosive and deadly disease. It killed more people in 24 weeks than AIDS has killed in 24 years.
And that's it. People do make comparisons between other various very severe disease outbreaks, AIDS, for example, or if you go back to the outbreak of the plague, bubonic plague, in the Middle Ages. Those are some of the things that we reach for comparisons. But you're saying that as far as those comparisons are concerned, that this influenza was much more deadly.
Well, in terms of percentage of population, it killed, you know, a much smaller percentage of the population than the plagues in Middle Ages. Obviously, the world is many more people in it in 1918 than in the 1400s, 1500s. But in terms of AIDS, in an absolute basis, without adjusting for population, it very likely killed more people, as I say, in a matter of weeks, really, than AIDS has killed and possibly even infected in the last quarter century. So it was a very lethal outbreak of influenza. Most of the people who got sick back then had the same kind of symptoms that we're familiar with today. You have an awful 2 or 3 days, but a week or 10 days later, you're fine. However, in a minority of cases, and it was not a tiny minority, sufferers had an entirely different experience. It was initially misdiagnosed. I mean, symptoms varied so much. Doctors initially diagnosed it as cholera, as typhoid, is dengue. Dengue is known as breakbone fever, give you a sense of what those symptoms are like. People could bleed not only from their mouth and nose, but from their ears and even from their eyes. It was really pretty gruesome. They, from lack of oxygen, they were turning dark blue, sometimes so dark that one physician said he couldn't distinguish between colored troops and white. So naturally that spread rumors of the Black Death, of bubonic plague. So it was a terrible outbreak, really.
And apparently then there was some percentage of the people who survived the disease initially and seemed to recover, then later succumbed to a secondary infection due to a bacterial pneumonia.
Correct. I mean, the most of the people, for example, who had those terrible symptoms I just talked about had a very serious invasion of the virus itself. And back then, of course, they couldn't do anything at all against a viral attack, nor can we do a heck of a lot today. But many people who recovered from a viral infection would then be subject to a secondary bacterial infection. And, of course, that was, you know, a fairly standard pneumonia, but back then, pneumonia was called the captain of the men of death. It was the number one cause of death. So many people died from bacterial infections. But a surprising number, more people than had generally been recognized or realized, died directly from the virus and not from bacterial invasion.
There has been a lot of speculation as to where the virus originated, and there are apparently some people who point to Europe, and there are some people who point to China. You make the argument in the book that you think that this virus actually originated in the United States, and very specifically in Kansas. What's the evidence, you think, for that as the origin point for the virus?
Well, all influenza viruses, all of them are natural to birds. None of them are human viruses. And periodically, a new virus will jump from birds to man. Generally speaking, most influenza outbreaks that we know about, going back several hundred years, seem to have originated in Asia. There's no scientific reason for that. It's simply because there more people are in close contact with animals. And therefore, it's more likely that the disease will jump species where there's more people in contact with animals. There is a hypothesis but there's no evidence whatsoever, really, no serious evidence. And people have looked at this very hard after the 1918 pandemic, that this disease started in the Orient. There is a hypothesis that it started in France, and there's some decent evidence for that, but I think the evidence is more compelling that it started in Kansas, but all of it's epidemiological evidence. The thing is, there was an outbreak in a small Kansas community, and the fact that it was isolated makes it highly unlikely that the disease went from somewhere else to this place, because there are no reports of disease anywhere around it. But you can trace by name several draftees who went from this community, Haskell County, Kansas, to what is now Fort Riley. And they carried the disease to Fort Riley, I believe. And Fort Riley is a place where the first known explosion of an epidemic form occurred in 1918. And we're talking about 72 hours after draftees from this area went to Fort Riley. So the timing is perfect for Haskell County, Kansas, to be the location. But I could be wrong on that. It seems like the most likely point of origin that's been suggested so far, however.
And there we start to get into the part of the story where you see the interconnections between the disease and the political atmosphere and realities of the time, because here this was World War One, and if, for example, one might speculate that if the authorities, public health people, and military authorities had realized they had some kind of serious problem, that if they had quarantined the base, if they said, okay, nobody is going anyplace, it could well have contained the spread of the disease. But because it was important, it was judged important that the American troops be involved in the war, what they did was they literally exported the disease to Europe with the soldiers that went from there across the Atlantic to fight.
Well, that's generally true. I don't think that any public health measures would have eliminated the disease. Influenza is just too contagious, unlike SARS, for example, which is fairly difficult to get. Influenza is just explosive. So I don't think they could have completely contained it, particularly after from the initial outbreaks when they didn't realize it was really a new disease. Because the virus, after it jumped to man, had to adapt to man first. It was in a new environment. And it wasn't particularly efficient initially at reproducing itself, and therefore the first cases weren't nearly as lethal as they later became in sort of a second wave of the disease. And therefore it was able to spread around the world before anybody largely noticed it while it was mutating. It was the second wave that was roughly 6 months later after it first surfaced in mankind that was lethal. By then it was too late to completely contain it, but I do think, and argue in the book, as you said, that more aggressive public health measures would have limited the damage instead, and it certainly would have limited the amount of terror that was out in the population. But because of the war, the entire attitude of the federal and local governments, not to mention the army authorities, was to pretend that this didn't exist and to start out reassuring people. And the reassurances that they gave were, of course, counterproductive. They worked at first, but what happened fairly quickly was that people saw that the disease obviously was something very deadly, and therefore they lost all faith in the authorities, and therefore the reassurances, once you lose trust in someone, you're not going to believe anything that they say. And you're sort of at sea. You feel alone and isolated. And that contributed to the terror and to the spread of the disease.
Yeah. So your sort of hypothesis is that the virus originated in this isolated community, that the war made it possible because soldiers either they went from that community outwards, or they came home for a visit, or however that worked, that they then took the virus that spread into military camps and probably would have spread from there around the country, but certainly it spread from there to Europe. And over that time, this was the time when the virus changed and mutated and became more deadly. And so when it then, again, if I understand this right, then it's reintroduced back from Europe into the United States, then we have a form of the virus that at that point
right.
is more deadly than it had been before.
That's pretty much correct. I mean, over it took the virus, a certain period of time to mutate in a way that it became deadly. And this was happening in the same number of generations all over the world, wherever it had been exposed. So in about the same time, it's sort of like water boiling in a pot. You see one bubble burst from the bottom of the pot at a time, and then all of a sudden the entire pot is a rolling boil. And that's sort of what happened with the virus. Some places it had skipped over in the first wave entirely, but none of them escaped the second wave. I don't know if I made sense there.
Yeah, no, yes, indeed. Maybe I'll introduce again our guest. We're talking with John Barry. He's the author of a recently published book entitled The Great Influenza, The Epic Story of the Deadliest Plague in History, and it's published by Viking. He's the author of four previous books, including one that got a lot of positive attention and won some awards, that book titled Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927 and How It Changed America. Questions?
Hopefully more than one got some positive.
Question. Well, that one and the other ones,
too. The other three were trashed by everybody.
Oh, well, that's sad, but I'm sure the great influenza is going to turn things around for you. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. A good part of the book is devoted to discussion of the state of medical science at the time and how physicians, doctors, some medical researchers responded to this challenge. And we do have to remind people that this was a time when we did not have antibiotics. We did not have a lot of the treatment methods that we have now, or even the methods to detect disease, or even the kind of understanding that we do have now about what it is that causes disease. The big difference between the level of medical technology in 1918 and that we have now.
Well, that's certainly true. By the same token, I think people underestimate how good the scientists were in 1918. And I really saw the book as a story of the first collision between modern science and epidemic disease. And let me just give you a sense of, and I focused on a relatively small group of scientists who were certainly the leading medical researchers in the country and probably the world, give you a sense of how good they were. One of them, Simon Flexner, and they didn't have antibiotics, but they did know how to manipulate the immune system. And Flexner got the death rate for bacterial meningitis, the most common bacterial meningitis, down to 18% in 1910, and according to the New England Journal of Medicine at the Massachusetts General Hospital, in the 1990s, the death rate for that disease was 25% with antibiotics. One of the other main characters in the book, Paul Lewis, not only he did prove that polio was a viral disease in 1908, in 1909, he developed a vaccine for polio that was 100% effective in protecting monkeys from the disease. It took half a century to move that work to man. One of the superstar scientists in the 20th century is another character in the book named Oswald Avery. As a direct result of the influenza research, although it didn't come until the 1940s, he was the one who actually discovered that DNA carries a genetic code, which was a highly surprising discovery. But he and there was a direct outgrowth of his research on influenza. He just kept plugging away for 25 years, studying actually the pneumococcus. And he and Jim Watson and Francis Crick and all the better-known Nobel laureates give Avery full credit for basically creating the field of modern molecular biology. I mean, there was another person in the book who won the Nobel Prize in 1966 for work he actually did in 1911. So these were first-rate scientists who are the characters in the book. And what they were capable of doing was really pretty astounding, even though they did not have antibiotics. And, in fact, they did not know back then that influenza was a viral disease.
I think you don't make the argument, though, that there were people within the scientific community who had this feeling that something like this was in the near future. They weren't really sure what it might be, but that they had this feeling that it was something that could and likely would happen, and it was something that they needed to prepare for. Maybe they weren't quite sure how to do that, but that it was something that was the possibility was out there.
Right. The military in World War I absorbed almost the entire medical profession. Every scientist I just mentioned was in the military during the war. And the Army Surgeon General, William Gorgas, anticipated an outbreak of an epidemic disease and organized the Army medicine trying to prevent it if he could. And oddly enough, he had enough knowledge of disease to expect this epidemic to be one of pneumonia, although what would be the cause of the pneumonia, he wasn't certain. And they really, that's part of why I saw this as a collision between epidemic disease and modern medicine, because Gorgas was smart enough to try to create an infrastructure in advance to deal with this, to try to create public health measures in the army camps to prevent it. Ultimately, of course, he was unsuccessful. But we were not just simply sitting passively and attacked by this disease. This was a much more active fight than you might expect.
Hmm. We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
This is really interesting to me because my grandfather was an old country doctor in Marion County, and he died during the war. He was just 49 from traveling all over and trying to help the patients and everything. I hadn't been born at that time. I'm 84 now. Or if I had, I was just one year old.
Well, if you look at the Journal of the American Medical Association during the epidemic, I was looking at it to read articles, medical articles on it, but you would come to just page after page after page in tiny print obituaries of doctors.
Oh, really?
Who had died every week, trying to do what your father did, was help people.
Grandfather.
The grandfather, okay.
Uh-huh.
But, it was a gruesome time.
Yeah, I know Dad wanted to be a doctor, but Dr. Holt said, no, it's too hard a life, and I don't want any of my children to be doctors.
Being a country doctor at the turn of the century.
Yeah, it'd be very difficult.
It was pretty tough.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I usually had to go by buggy, and then after they had the Model T Fordway, they got one of the very first ones. But in a lot of times, the weather and the roads were so horrible, you couldn't go out that way, and you had to go back by buggy.
Right, and I noted that one of the advantages back then of using a horse and buggy was you could go to sleep, and the horse would take you home, and you can't do that in a car.
Yeah, sometimes. And sometimes they would have to leave the buggy and swim across the river or the creek when it's real swollen and go on from there. They were really dedicated men.
Well, I appreciate the call. I thank you very much. Mr. Berry, what was the mortality rate among healthcare workers at the time?
Well, there aren't very good numbers on that. I can't give you a precise number. But as I say, literally page after page after, of JAMA was just filled in with tiny print.
Mm-hmm.
So it was unusually high. And back then, infectious disease was the chief killer. Doctors generally had better immune systems because they were exposed to so many diseases. If they survived, the immune system is a classic case of that which doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But they certainly took a risk. Today, infectious diseases are not, in general, number one killers, and doctors generally don't have to worry about sickness. But in the case of some of the emerging diseases today, you're getting doctors who are very reluctant to treat patients or to become first responders, healthcare workers, because they're afraid not only for themselves, but that they'll take these diseases home and kill their families. Back then, something that doctors had to live with, and nurses, of course, as well. They had to live with on a daily basis and just accepted it as a risk.
One of the things that made this virus a little bit unusual was the its pattern of who it struck hardest, because you would expect that it perhaps would be the weakest people whose systems would be least able to fight off the disease that might be likely to be affected. So there you would be talking about basically babies and old people, the youngest and the oldest. But one of the things that was characteristic of this virus is that it seemed to hit most hard at people who were, say, between 20 and 40, who you would have expected perhaps to be those who would have been most able to, whose immune systems should have been the most able to deal with it.
That's exactly right. And the irony is that the immune systems were their immune systems were stronger, and that was what was killing them, the immune system itself. What was happening was the virus was getting into the lungs, and the immune system followed the virus there and attacked it. It didn't have specific attacks because it didn't fully recognize the virus, and therefore it unleashed every weapon the immune system has, and it has some very lethal weapons. And the battlefield was your lung. So in wiping out the virus, it was destroying the lungs. It was sort of like the comment by the Army officer in Vietnam who said we had to destroy the village to save it. That was what was going on. And your immune system changes over age. When you're very young and old, it's weaker, and it's strongest in young adults. And these young adults were being killed by their own immune systems. In fact, in the United States, the death toll among people aged 20 to 35 was actually double the death toll for everybody aged 50 or over, which is exactly the reverse of what would normally, in fact, more than the reverse, what would be the normal case in an influenza outbreak.
There have been attempts, and I'm not sure whether, in fact, any of these had succeeded. There have been attempts to go out and actually collect samples of the virus so that it could then be its DNA could be mapped so that perhaps
right.
we could get a better understanding of what it was, exactly what it was, and how it worked. And then I guess the idea is, you know, forewarned is forearmed, that maybe we could understand, get a better understanding of the virus and possibly right. better deal with a similar kind of outbreak in future. Where does that work stand?
Well, there was a highly publicized effort about digging bodies up in Scandinavia. Hmm. There was a New Yorker article, and actually there was a book that came out a few years ago that basically told that story. And that effort failed. However, while that publicized effort was going on, a scientist named Jeff Taubenberger at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in Washington actually managed to pull the virus off some old tissue samples preserved by the Army from soldiers who had died of the disease. And since then, he's gotten several more samples, from one from Alaska, one, I believe, from England. And there's a whole team of people who are trying to sequence the genome of the virus. And there was actually some X-ray crystallography published in earlier this year, it showed that this virus very likely came directly from birds to man. There's a hypothesis that viruses, that influenza viruses, often pass through mammals, usually probably pigs, mm-hmm. On their way to man. But this one seemed to jump directly to man. Just as, you know, this is fairly current information. Actually, earlier this year, there were 24 deaths in Asia out of 36 people exposed to a new influenza virus that went directly from birds to people. All those people died directly from exposure to birds. None of them got the disease from another person. The virus hasn't mutated, thankfully, at this point, to pass from person to person. If that ever happened, we would have another outbreak of disease that might make 1918 look like a cakewalk.
Yeah. And that is, I guess, one of the bottom line questions that people always ask when we talk about this, what happened in 1918, 1919, and that is, could this happen again?
It's inevitable that it's going to happen again. Well, any influenza expert will tell you the virus is one of the fastest mutating of all viruses in existence. It mutates literally a million times faster than a more stable DNA virus. And because of that, and because it exists in the wild in birds, and because it can pass from wild birds to farm chickens and turkeys and so forth, it's inevitable that at some point another new influenza virus is going to pass into man and mutate in a way that it can be transmitted from one person to another. It's not automatically inevitable that you get a 1918 type explosion. We'd have, or a lethality, you'd get the same explosion because nobody's immune system will have seen that virus before. It will explode across the world, but it may not be as all that deadly. I mean, in 1968 and in 1957, there were pandemics from new viruses. Neither of those, 1957 was fairly serious, but nothing at all like 1918, and 1916 was barely, in terms of mortality, barely a blip, although it made a lot of people sick. So the question is, and the World Health Organization has a monitoring system in place looking for the next influenza virus to try to cut it off. That's one reason they were able to contain SARS, because they activated this system, this infrastructure that already existed. But SARS, as I said earlier, is much less dangerous than influenza because it's not nearly as contagious. And also because it's not the person who's sick doesn't begin producing infectious particles until after he has symptoms, whereas in influenza, and that means that you can isolate them because they've already shown symptoms. In influenza, it's a reverse. You can infect people before you show any symptoms. So it's almost impossible to isolate people. But just in the last week or so, this virus that they killed well over 100 million birds in Asia earlier this year, the virus has resurfaced in Thailand last week. And it's not going away because it exists in wild birds. We can only hope that it never mutates in a way that it can pass from one person to another, because that is a lethal virus. That is, 24 out of 36 people died earlier this year. That's pretty scary numbers.
Our guest is John Barry. He is author of the book, The Great Influenza, The Epic Story of the Deadliest Plague in History. It's published by Viking. It's out now in the bookstore. And questions are welcome. We have a couple of people here standing by, ready to go. And we'll talk with someone in Champaign next, line number one. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
Wondering about medical practice. I'd read in Wallace Stegner's Big Rock Candy Mountain about whiskey running during the influenza epidemic, and which was of course profitable, but the excuse for it was that it was medicinal somehow. I'm wondering, is that some sort of euphemism, or was there a real medicinal use for whiskey in the influenza epidemic?
Well, prohibition hadn't come in yet, so liquor was everywhere pretty much. The issue was that in practically every city in the country, they closed saloons. Along with churches, schools, theaters, and every place of public gathering. And people could only get alcohol in most places with a doctor's prescription. So there was whiskey running in that sense. Whether or not it did or didn't help people in terms of influenza, well, number one, it doesn't. Back then, there was some actual real medical debate over whether it did or didn't. That's where the whiskey running would have come in. As I say, prohibition hadn't been in place yet.
Oh, I see. Oh, but saloons were closed. Okay. Because they make a big deal about it being extremely hard to get and only... okay. Well, thank you then.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to Chicago for someone else. Line four. Hello.
Hi. I joined the conversation late, so I hope that I'm not raising questions you already discussed, but I wanted some information about the psychological effect. One of the things you said was how the fluid, it struck the young and the healthy, it seemed. And I was wondering if that increased the fear factor among people at that time, that this disease seemed to strike people who were usually immune or at least could fight diseases better. And the second part of that question is that quite often after the flu, there's depression. And I think I heard you talk about this on another show where you spoke about Woodrow Wilson and thinking that many of his policies towards the treaty of with Germany at that time and his was affected by his either depression from the flu or weakness and his inability to perhaps negotiate for a better treaty.
Okay. First, there was terror out there, and the Red Cross reports, talked of a terror akin to the Middle Ages and the Black Death. In part, I did talk a little bit about this earlier. In Chicago, for example, the Commissioner of Public Health said, quote, "Nothing was done to interfere with the morale of the community. It is our duty to keep the people from fear. Worry kills more people than the epidemic." And what that meant, what that translated, was that he kept telling everybody there was no problem. He would publicly say worry kills more than the disease, and that this was just plain old ordinary la grippe. But at the same time, when you're seeing a neighbor who's 25 years old die in 24 hours, you pretty soon stop believing his reassurances. And that contributed to the terror, as, of course, to the death of all these young, healthy people. In Camp Grant in Rockford, Illinois, was one of the worst-hit camps, one of the poorest-run camps, too, in terms of public health. The camp commander there overruled his medical staff in terms of trying to isolate people and so forth. And on the day the 500th soldier died of influenza in Camp Grant, the camp commandant committed suicide, shot himself. There was tremendous terror in the population. There was also, there are clear links between influenza and all sorts of neurological diseases, including Parkinson's. There's a new study about to be published that pretty definitively links stroke, influenza and stroke. Depression, definitely, that was very often cited. And Wilson, in the middle of the Paris peace talks, got influenza. It was quite severe. His doctor, who was a very fine physician, thought he was going to die. In fact, retroactively, historians have thought that what he had was not influenza but a minor stroke. It clearly disoriented him, and right after this, he gave up all these concessions to Clemenceau. But it wasn't a stroke. In fact, it was quite definitely influenza. I mean, all the symptoms. You have 103-degree fever. You have coughing fits. You have all these other symptoms. You know, stroke doesn't cause any of them. Without any doubt, it was influenza, and it seems quite clear that the influenza is what disoriented him in the midst of the negotiations, and probably certainly contributed, nobody knows how much, to the result.
Okay, and then if I may have a last question, what about the outbreak of the avian flu virus in Texas? Did you talk about that?
Well, I didn't talk about that. There are some influenza viruses that have never demonstrated any pathological problems for man. The ones that have occurred so far in the United States in the past year, in Delaware, in New Jersey, in Texas, I believe there's been an outbreak this year in Canada as well. Those have not been demonstrated to cause problems for man directly.
But there is
a potential danger there. It's not the same danger as the H5N1 virus in Asia, but there's a potential danger there, and that's why when influenza infects a flock, they're routinely slaughtered.
Those aren't sold, are they?
What's that?
Are they sold for human consumption?
Well, even if they they're generally slaughtered and destroyed, but you can't get influenza from eating an infected bird. You know, it's a virus, and a virus needs a live cell to replicate in. I mean, the virus can exist for a limited time outside a living cell. One reason it's more common in the winter is because there's lower humidity during the winter, and it can exist longer in the air for several hours during the winter, and that time is cut short in the summer. And there are some other epidemiological reasons, like more people are inside during the winter, and that's another reason why it's a winter disease. But you couldn't get it from eating a bird.
Okay.
You could get it from in birds. It's not a respiratory disease. It's an intestinal disease. So it would be in the waste products from birds that it would be dangerous. Poultry workers who wade through all the bird populations living, they're vulnerable to a bird virus, and those are the people who got sick in Asia.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go next to southeastern Illinois, line number one, for someone else. Hello.
Yes, I came in late in this program, and so I don't know whether you've already mentioned this or not, but I saw you on C-SPAN 2, and what amazed me was you said that the fighting the epidemic was hampered by the laws against criticizing the government, that somebody could be sent to prison for 20 years for criticizing the government. In fact, I think you said one congressman was sentenced to 15 years.
Right. Victor Berger from Wisconsin was sentenced to something like 10 years in jail. He was expelled from the House and reelected by his constituents, but the House refused to see him after he was reelected. This goes back to the morale issue. We were in the middle of a war, so people who handled the propaganda machine, which it was the first propaganda machine that the government ever produced, the Committee for Public Information, tried to put a positive spin on everything. And that can work in the short term. But in the long term, what it does when the truth conflicts with the spin you're putting out there is destroy the credibility of people in authority. And I don't know if you were listening when I quoted the Chicago Public Health Commissioner, who said it is our duty to keep the people from fear. Worry kills more people than the epidemic. So what he did and what all over the country health officials were doing initially was in effect lying, most of them were, by telling people that there was no problem. But the whole atmosphere was created by the war and by the Wilson administration. Let me read you briefly the law called the Sedition Act that made it punishable by 20 years in jail to, quote, utter, print, write, or publish any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the government of the United States, unquote. You could go to jail even if what you said about the government was true, if you were castigating it. It seems like a clear violation of free speech, but in fact that law was upheld by the Supreme Court.
Could you imagine anything like that? I mean, any congressman being sent to prison today for criticizing the government?
Well, I couldn't imagine it back then either, but it does make the Patriot Act look pale in comparison, frankly.
Yeah. Well, I found the C-SPAN interesting, and I'll continue to listen to this. I did hear you quote the man from Chicago, the public health official from Chicago.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well,
thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is John Barry. If you're interested in reading his book, it's titled The Great Influenza, The Epic Story of the Deadliest Plague in History, and it's published by Viking. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly, it seems to be, there seem to be a number of examples that you can cite where public policy, government policy, both on the national level and on the local level, actually facilitated transmission of the spread of the disease.
That's exactly right. I mean, you were talking earlier about the military's refusal to heed the very good advice from some very good officers in the military, including its own Surgeon General. Not so much in spreading disease, but in terms of killing people, they can, despite almost unanimous advice from the medical community, they continued to ship troops to Europe. And you can imagine what a troop ship was like. To say people were packed like sardines is an accurate comparison. And influenza would just erupt through these ships, and some of them became effectively floating coffins. Earlier I talked about Camp Grant, which was in Rockford. Just as the epidemic was getting underway at that camp, 3,000 troops got on a train to Georgia, another very closely confined type of travel, and 2,000 of those troops were hospitalized when they got to the camp, and hundreds of them died. And that was, you know, clearly, that intense breathing of the people got massive exposures to the virus, and clearly many of those deaths were the direct result of the camp commandant's refusal to listen to his medical officers.
Yeah. Another one of the stories that you tell in the book that's really gripping is the story of the experience in the city of Philadelphia. And there, another example where local government officials could have done more to quarantine, to contain the spread of the disease, and in fact did not. And there's the story of there was a parade scheduled.
Right, the Liberty Loan parade. And, you know, the newspapers refused to publish letters from doctors calling for it to be called off. The medical community was urging the public health official to cancel the Liberty Loan parade. But we were at war, he wanted Philadelphia to meet its quota for, you know, selling Liberty bonds. The parade went forward, and, you know, 72 hours later, again, influenza. I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, all closely packed, breathing on each other, and right after the parade, the disease just exploded through the city. And it was probably the hardest hit city in the United States, and certainly part of that reason would have been the timing that all those people were exposed during that parade.
Yeah. So many people died, there were so many bodies that they simply couldn't cope, that they didn't have enough coffins.
Well, that was true in almost every city in the country. They were using steam shovels to dig mass graves in cemeteries, and they were loading bodies in without coffins, as you say. I mean, you literally in Philadelphia had priests driving horse-drawn carts down the streets calling upon people to bring out their dead. Bodies would lie in the houses for several days. So it really was like the Middle Ages. And going back to the terror, the place just shut down. There was one physician he was then a medical student. He was given charge of an emergency hospital in the middle of the city, and he lived 12 miles outside the city. And he drove. Philadelphia was then a city of 2 million people. After he left work, there were so few cars on the street, he started counting the cars that he passed on his way home. And one night, in 12 miles in a city of 2 million people, he did not pass a single other car. He said the life of the city has almost stopped. And there's another picture of New York City. There's a photo in the book in which I point out the photos of a sanitation worker with a mask on his face. But the caption points out there's not a single pedestrian on the sidewalk. There's not a single car driving down the street in the middle of New York City in the middle of the day.
Yeah, there's a man behind him with a white coat in a vehicle that looks probably like it's an ambulance, or maybe it's a hearse. I don't know. Some kind of emergency kind of vehicle.
Yeah.
What happened to cause the disease to stop?
Well, two things. Number one, people's immune systems began to adjust to it. Once they could recognize the virus, they could develop antibodies. So after it passed through a community, and by the time it came back, the immune systems could cope. And in addition, the virus itself, this was an unusually lethal virus. Most influenza viruses are not that lethal. And I believe, although I can't prove this is speculation, I think, you know, there's sort of a statistical concept, the reversion to the mean. I think it's likely that that's not a law, it's just a concept that when something is on an extreme, it's most likely to move toward the common, toward the average. And I think the virus probably mutated in the direction of an average influenza virus, which, of course, would be less lethal. And 1919 was a very bad year. 1920 was a very bad year, although not like 1918. But by the late 20s, the virus had died down and was pretty much like a normal influenza virus.
You talked about the fact that it's almost inevitable that we will have something as bad as this again. Then I guess the question is, given the fact that we do have some methods of treatment, we have greater potential for trying to limit the spread of disease, and we're out there, we're looking for it. The hope is, at least, that we have our eyes open and that we're trying to catch something like that very early. Do you think that if we had something that was this bad come along again, would we cope better than we were able to in 1918?
Well, as of right now, not a heck of a lot better. Everybody who knows anything about influenza is out there trying to draw attention to the threat, particularly with the virus in Asia, a real threat for, I mean, again, unfortunately, if that ever becomes transmissible person to person, it would make not only 1918, but it might make AIDS look like a cakewalk in terms of, I mean, hundreds of millions of people would be vulnerable. But we know what we need to do. For example, this monitoring system the World Health Organization has, fewer than half the countries in the world participate. Even those that do participate, great areas of China, for example, are not monitored. In addition, the countries have to tell the truth about public health issues. They have to report to the World Health Organization, not cover it up. That's a lesson that may not have been learned yet. I hope it has been. There are some anti-influenza drugs, antiviral drugs, that have demonstrated some effectiveness, but there's no supply of them. They need to be stockpiled. All this needs money. Vaccines are very effective, but every virus is a little bit different. You know, it mutates so fast. Even your standard virus mutates from year to year, and they have to adjust the vaccine. If you get a new virus, you'd have to produce hundreds of millions of doses and distribute and administer that in a matter of months. We don't have the capability of doing that right now.
I'm pardoning me for interrupting you, but I'm going to jump in there because we've just come to the end of the time and we're going to have to stop. For more detail on the story, though, again, I suggest to people look for the book, The Great Influenza, published by Viking, by our guest, John Berry. Mr. Berry, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thanks very much yourself.
Programming here on AM 580 made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday.